Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is novelist and cultural historian, Ruth Brandon, and we're talking about her new book, Spellbound by Marcel, Duchamp, Love, and Art. Ruth, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, that's I always enjoy talking about Marcel. He's a very interesting man.
Well, I was going to ask you, how did you come to write this book? Like, what was it? And then it sort of answers itself if you know anything about the person.
Well, I did, because about in the mid-90s, I wrote a book about surrealism called mm-hmm. Surreal Lives. And although Marcel Duchamp wasn't a surrealist, I had a chapter in my book about him called The Man Who Wasn't There, because he was never where you expected him to be, and he was usually not around. I was very interested in him. This book began as a film, really. A film director friend of mine and I, in about 2014, thought it would be fun to do a film for 2017, which would have been the 100th anniversary of the Urinal, which was his most famous artwork. It was the beginning of conceptual art, the Urinal that he failed to exhibit in New York in 1917.
Better known as the Fountain.
Sorry?
Better known as the Fountain.
Yes, better known as the Fountain. That's right. We nearly got it financed, but in the end we didn't, and it fell through like so many films do. And by then, it became clear that the real center of that story, at least as far as I was concerned, was Beatrice Wood, who was at that time a coming young woman in New York who wanted to be an artist, and who was taken up by Duchamp, and fell in love with him, and then fell in love with his friend, who he handed her on to, Henri Pierre-Rocher. And so I thought it would actually be much easier to deal with all this as a book, where you can have a much longer time frame, because a film is much more like a short story than it is like a long, complex book. And so I wrote it and then tried to sell it, which is quite the wrong way round to go. With nonfiction, you get a commission and then you write it. But I had the stuff anyway, so I wrote it, and we sold it to Pegasus in New York.
Well, you know, it's interesting, because when you mentioned the film, that was in my mind the entire time. Not necessarily a documentary, but I can see a cinema treatment of this story. Because the whole thing is great. I mean, it's just a great, complicated story. And the central figure, we've got to get into this book. The central figure is the artist Marcel Duchamp. And I love the quote, always approachable, always unreadable.
Absolutely. And well, yes, that's what we thought, that it was a drama, really. And we wrote, the treatment we wrote was a drama treatment, not a documentary. But it ended in 1918 when everybody left New York. And that wasn't really very satisfactory, because the story went on long
after
that.
That's right.
And you couldn't really deal with that in a film. I mean, certainly not in a drama, because it's just not the right shape. So I was quite glad. I mean, it was fun writing the book. But the basis of the book, apart from sort of the stuff about Duchamp, which is really very well known and has been mulled over by art historians more or less ad nauseam, what was the diaries of Beatrice Wood and the other member of the three, Henri Pierre-Rocher, both kept day-to-day diaries, only tiny bits of which have been published, because art historians, in my experience, have tunnel vision, and they weren't interested in anything that didn't have directly to do with Duchamp and the Fountain. So I had all this extraordinary material, and what emerged as you read these diaries is that you were looking really at two quite different series of events. I mean, you really would hardly recognize the same things going on with Rocher and Beatrice Wood, even when they were having an affair with each other. So I thought, you know, what absolute gold. These things are much more easily available than they used to be. You can get the whole thing online. And so I've had all this to play with, as well as Beatrice Wood's extraordinarily unbridled love letters to Rocher, which are all in the Philadelphia Museum, and which nobody had used except her very briefly in her own autobiography. So I had all this amazing material. And the thing that the art historians never seem to have didn't seem to be interested in, really, was that Marcel's works of art, his fountain and his great glass, the bride undressed by her bachelors even, and his peep show that he did towards the end of his life, that is a rather horrible, obscene peep show of what looks like a post-rape scene.
You're talking about Etant Donné?
Etant Donné, yes. They all reflect his own state of mind. They're autobiographical works, really. The Fountain is about what he thought about the art world. That's to say, he thought it was a load of shit. Well, he thought it was a load of piss. And the other two are about the unattainable woman, because the only women he really fell in love with were, for the first 60 years of his life, were the women who didn't want, who for different reasons, didn't want to give themselves to him. And the bride is unattainable by her bachelors, and the rape scene, it's about his lover, Maria Martins, who was the wife of the Brazilian ambassador at the time to America. And in both cases, the women, although they enjoyed themselves with Marcel, didn't want to spend their lives with him. Gabi Picabia, who was the first one, was married to his best friend, Francis Picabia, who was an artist, and was very fond of Marcel, might even have been in love with him, but wasn't going to leave Picabia. And Maria Martins wasn't going to leave her husband. So that these are really monuments to frustration, as well as everything else. I was very surprised, actually, that when, as often happened, art historians were given my book to review, they all said that I didn't deal with the art. Well, in fact, I did.
Oh, you clearly dealt with the art. What you did do, which is why I appreciate this book so much, is you dealt with the personality and the people, so that I felt I got a better understanding of the person who made the art. And that makes all the difference in the world.
Well, yes. These are people, you know. I always used to say to my daughter when she was trying to do some impossible thing, look, human beings do these things. And human beings make artworks. And human beings interact with other human beings. And to have these diaries giving such an extraordinarily ground-level view of what was going on was an absolute gift. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed writing this book. It was such fun.
Well, let's start with Marcel.
Sorry?
Well, let's start with Marcel, okay, when we're talking about the book. What I got from your book is, this is my sort of classic image of Marcel, is a guy at a party standing in the corner, occasionally smiling cryptically. Everybody wanted to talk with Marcel, to be with him, but mostly he was just opaque.
That's right. He really, I think, was not bothered by the effect he had on other people. I mean, which is quite unusual. Most of us, you know, are to some extent self-conscious. I really think that Marcel Duchamp had not a shred of self-consciousness.
His greatest work is his life, as written in your book.
Yes, absolutely. He just did exactly what he wanted to do. I mean, I think of this as quite a feminist book in a way, partly because the heroine, Beatrice Wood, one of the protagonists, really, in my view, turns out to be the heroine because she achieves what she wants to do and against the odds. But what struck me very, very forcibly was that one reason that Marcel was able to live exactly as he wanted to was because if you were a man, you could take risks that you absolutely couldn't do if
right.
you were a female member of decent society. So there was Beatrice Wood, who was an unmarried girl who wanted to be an artist. And until she was able, and as an unmarried girl in New York, you had no freedom of maneuver unless you were attached to a man. So at that point, she was attached to her father. And later on, much, much later on, she lived to be 105. she managed to achieve financial independence through being a potter. But if you look at Marcel's the description of Marcel's lodgings, I mean, they were squalid. They were totally squalid. They were horrendous. No girl could have been allowed to live like that. And it was it was an extraordinarily male-controlled society, except for married women who could do what they like if they were prepared to take the risk.
Her mother was a problem in this.
Her mother, well, yes, many mothers are a problem.
Well, she was worried. She was worried about her daughter's, quote, bohemianization.
Well, her mother wanted, Beatrice's mother wanted her to marry well. She wanted her to marry somebody with a lot of money so that she would lead a comfortable life like her mother and wasn't too bothered about whether Beatrice would love her husband because Mrs. Wood didn't love her husband and she led a comfortable life spending his money. But Beatrice, having experienced life in Marcel's coterie, realized that there were other possibilities and wasn't happy to go along with this. So that you get this story of a respectable girl being faced with the picture, with life being lived in a way that respectable girls absolutely didn't live life. And it almost broke her.
Well, but she was terribly enamored and frustrated with Marcel.
Well, yes, and not only him, but also Henri Pierre Rocher.
Oh, God. Well, wait a minute. That's another story. Let's start, because I want to make sure we mention Rocher, because I knew nothing about Rocher.
Well, he's such a strange character.
Call him a dog. He was, as you write about in the book, he was not very good at doing much of anything. He listened rather than talked, which was made up for a lot of his charm. And he did things like he wrote a novel on which Truffaut's film Jules et Jim was based.
Yeah.
But basically, he just sort of bedded everybody he saw.
That's right. He was a genuine sexaholic. I mean, he genuinely, what he enjoyed was falling in love. He really did. He was prone to fall in love with almost any woman that he met. And what he enjoyed was the chase. He had no desire whatever to become actually involved with any of them. So, if you were, this is actually quite a difficult situation even today for young women to deal with, because women, are more inclined to fall in love and to associate sex with emotion. And it seemed to me that Rocher only really fell in love with men. He didn't want to go to bed with them, but what he did want to do was share women with them. And so Beatrice he shared with Marcel.
That's right.
And he shared the woman that he almost married with a German poet called Franz Hessel.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the sense that he was going to bed with his with the women of the men that he was in love with that gave him his big emotional thrill, it seems to me.
He also kept a diary of all his encounters, including some incredible abbreviations for different sex acts, like KPF.
Yeah, he kept a sex diary.
Well, first of all, you wrote this, not me. He was an expert at oral sex, and he would talk about that and abbreviate it KPF, which stood for?
Well, yes. I mean, KPF stood for Kiss Petite Femme, Kiss the Little Woman.
Was that a known abbreviation, or is that something
he made up? No. I mean, he kept his diary in three languages, in French, English, and German, and it was all mixed up. But, I mean, he just described in it the sex acts that he'd been involved in the night before, and he described them in great detail. And as far as Beatrice was concerned, he never actually had penetrative sex with her. And so somebody said to me, why did I think she... one of the critics said they thought they couldn't understand this obsession with whether or not they had penetrative sex. But, of course, she didn't want to because she was afraid of getting pregnant.
That's right. And that was a real problem.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, that would really have ruined her reputation. That would have made her completely unmarriageable. And God knows what her mother would have done. I mean, that would have been an impossible situation. That was why it was much easier, once you were married, to lead the kind of free sex life that coterie of men and women did.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is novelist and cultural historian Ruth Brandon. And we're talking about her new book, which is, I think it's a really interesting history, Spellbound by Marcel, Duchamp, Love, and Art. Ruth, there were so many other interesting people in this story, too. But first, I want to address the fact is we need to talk about why all these European people ended up in New York City. And throughout the book, there's this sort of exchange between especially Paris and New York City. And why are they going back and forth, and what is each group getting out of this?
Yeah, I found this very interesting. I mean, in the first instance, the reason that Marcel Duchamp, Francis Picabia, and a lot of avant-garde French artists came to New York was to escape World War I. And Marcel came in 1915, and a lot more came in 1916. He had a heart murmur, and he couldn't fight, which, of course, he was glad about, but it made life in Paris impossible. And so, anyway, all these... this was just a couple of years after the Armory Show in 1913 in New York had introduced Americans to European modern art, which was more or less unknown in America, and had caused an enormous scandal, had been a kind of political scandal in the way that political scandals light on one particular thing and then move on. It signified liberalism, if you like, and
well, it was particularly New Descending the Staircase by Duchamp that was singled out and talked about, screamed about, and parodied.
Yeah. Well, anyway, once they were in New York, all these Europeans felt immensely free in a way that they never did in Europe. But conversely, a lot of American women in particular felt exactly the same when they left America and went to Paris. And I think it was because at that time the world was a much smaller place. Air travel didn't exist. It took several days to cross the Atlantic by sea. And it was a different world once you arrived at the other side. I mean, continents were really separated. And I think people found an immense freedom in leaving the continent where they felt oppressed in some way or unable to do what they wanted and reaching another continent where they weren't known and nobody cared what they did. And I think that was very important for all the men and women in this story, really.
like I said, there's a whole cast of characters that's fascinating to follow their trajectory throughout this story. And the Arensbergs.
The Arensbergs.
That was fascinating, their story in this.
I mean, they were both immensely industrially rich. Walter Arensberg had steel money, and Lou Arensberg had textiles money. She was a Stevens from the textiles factories in Massachusetts. And Walter had great intellectual pretensions, but he was a failed poet, really, and they didn't need to work at all. They didn't have any children, and their life was going to be quite unfulfilled, really, when an old friend of Walter Arensberg's, who was an art critic in New York, said, "You must come to the Armory Show. You can see all this stuff," and he came along and was enchanted by modern art, and decided that what he was going to be was a collector. And then when the people who'd been painting these pictures all came over to New York during World War I, he decided that he would collect people as well. So the Arensberg formed a salon, which was the center for all these, for Duchamp and his friends to meet more or less every night. And they did all sorts of different things. I mean, they did spiritualism. They turned tables. They drank whiskey. They ate chocolate cake. They fell in love with each other. They fell out of love with each other. They had parties. It was one of those peak moments that doesn't last long, but that informs a lot of stuff that comes after it.
There are so many incidents that we could talk about, and again, even minor characters in this book, like Arthur Craven, are fascinating people in and of themselves. It was interesting.
Arthur Craven.
Yeah, Arthur Craven. What a weirdo.
Absolutely.
Boxer, poet, as you write about in the book.
Well, he was set up.
By Duchamp.
to give a lecture about modern art, and they got him immensely drunk to begin with before he began. And once he got, he was immensely late arriving at the lecture, and once he did arrive, he started to undress, and it was an immense scandal because all the audience was society ladies, and they'd never seen anything like it. And apparently he was the most charming chap when he wasn't drunk. He was Oscar Wilde's nephew. And one of the coterie, Mina Loy, fell in love with him, and they eloped to Mexico. But on the way, he disappeared. He set out in a small boat to sail from Mexico to Argentina, where he was hoping to actually be able to earn a living, and disappeared and left her by herself with the baby daughter, and. Biology really does dictate what goes on then as now.
We only have a few minutes left, and we've only scratched the surface of this book. I found one of the more interesting relationships was Duchamp and Man Ray.
And, sorry?
Man Ray. Because that lasted their entire life. Man Ray and Duchamp were always very close.
Yes, they were. I mean, he was a very good friend once he was your friend. He was tremendously kind and tremendously caring if you were his friend. And it was just that you weren't to fall in love with him. That was the one thing that he couldn't take.
And he did help Beatrice with a work of art, too, that was going to be in the big show where R. Mutt's piece was going to show up too. And that was didn't he help Beatrice with a work of art, Duchamp?
Who did he help?
Beatrice.
Oh, Beatrice. Well, not really. I mean,
she did
something. The coterie decided to put on a show in New York. And Beatrice was going to put in a work of her own. Duchamp decided he wasn't going to put in a work. He never did. But of course, everybody went to it hoping that there would be a Duchamp work because that would be scandalous. But the real scandal turned out to be Beatrice's work, and she'd done this very milk and water picture, or a view from above of a girl in a bath. And Duchamp, when he saw this, suggested that she goes and buys a shell-shaped cake of soap to put over her pubic hair, which she did. And of course, what that and this was, he named this a bit of soap.
Well, it was originally called a bit of soap in the water, renamed it a bit of water in the soap.
A bit of water in the soap, that's right. And, of course, what the effect of this was obscene. I mean, the effect of this was to draw attention to precisely what the soap was concealing. And as it turned out, this artwork was the scandal of the exhibition. If people had known that it was actually a Duchamp, then it would have been even more of a scandal. But as it was, Beatrice had to cope with her mother by herself.
We're completely out of time, unfortunately. And like I mentioned, we have barely scratched the surface of this very complicated story with a lot of people that are in it that are fascinating. My guest tonight has been novelist and cultural historian Ruth Brandon. And we're talking about her new book. It's a really good read. Spellbound by Marcel. Duchamp, Love, and Art. Ruth, it's been a pleasure. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.